Rachel.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Okay, so I guess we should introduce ourselves. My name's Michelle Goldberg. I am the author of a new book called The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, which is about the global battle over women's rights and women's fertility set against a kind of globalized fundamentalist movement. This is the book. I'm holding it up to the camera for all to see at home. And I'm also a senior correspondent for The American Prospect.
Okay. And I am the author of a new book on a related topic called In Her Own Sweet Time, Unexpected Adventures in Finding Love, Commitment, and Motherhood. I'm going to hold it up to the camera for all to see. And my book is on it's about the trend of women having children later, in mostly in the U.S., but around the world. It seems to be a growing trend that women are postponing motherhood, putting their career first, often waiting to find Mr. Right. And there are a lot of new choices coming along with this trend, which is, you know, everything from single motherhood to choosing to get your eggs frozen to postpone motherhood till later to adoption to using fertility drugs down the line to using surrogates to a whole new economy between older women and younger women that involves donor eggs.
So although we come at this from pretty different directions, although I think it's interesting that we both found so much, and the reason that I think it's a good match to have us talking here today is because we're both writing about really kind of radical changes in the way that human beings, and particularly women, organize their lives. You know, changes that are in some ways unprecedented, and you can see the anxiety that creates rippling through both, you know, kind of domestic and international politics in...
Yeah, I was fascinated by your chapter, The Birth Strike, which talks about the fact that, you know, fertility rates are dropping in a lot of developing countries. And you know, I was wondering, you know, what you found that to be, you know, that what reason is for that, you know, is related very similarly to In Her Own Sweet Time, which is that women are having trouble, it seems, reconciling work and home life, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if you saw Ruth Reichel. Is that how you pronounce her name, Reichel?
Yeah, she called for a new women's movement on a TV show. I can't remember.
Right,
the name
and she
of
was
TV.
Talking about how incredibly brutal it is for many women who are trying to reconcile work and family, and how in certain ways it's rather than getting better with the advent of the women's movement, it's gotten worse. And a lot of people like to blame the women's movement for this, which makes me crazy. And one of the things that I found so fascinating in researching that chapter, which is about the panic over the declining population rates in Europe and the fact that, you know, it has real repercussions. And one of the repercussions we can already see in the triumph of some of the right-wing parties in the recent European elections, you know, like the British National Party, and the right-wing party in Sweden, the Swedish Democrats, came very close to getting a seat, although they were actually bumped off by the Pirate Party, which is the file-sharing party.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, there's this kind of, you know, there's this real rumbling about immigration and about what today someone from the British National Party I saw in the Times called creeping Islamicization.
Right.
And part of that's about...
You finished your point, but I wanted to say that about immigration, it seems to me that immigration is what is keeping the birth rates higher in the United States, that if it wasn't for immigration, that actually we'd be having a birth strike and birth crisis as well, right?
Well, I don't know if we'd be having a birth crisis. We definitely have below replacement fertility.
Right, and replacement fertility, what's replacement fertility?
It's 2.1 children per woman, because basically that accounts for, you know, a certain number of children or young adults who are going to die before they have children themselves.
Right. So, I mean, so should there be replacement? I mean, should the population just get smaller? I mean, what are the solutions here? I mean, in my book, I talk about this, you know, this baby panic that a lot of women are feeling. I mean, I talk from much more of a personal point of view, which is, you know, you hit the age of 35 is the age where you enter into the realm of a high risk pregnancy, and you have a higher chance for birth anomalies. And so all of these women are also peaking in their careers around these ages. And so, you know, the question is, you know, what are the solutions, and does there need to be a new kind of movement and a new kind of way to make it possible for, you know, women to have children within their fertile years and also work?
I think we already can see what that looks like. And this is one of the, you know, one of the key points that I try to make is that although birth rates are falling all over the developed world, they're falling fastest and kind of catastrophically in the countries where there is no, where there's no reconciliation either in terms of individual families or society, the way jobs work, the way pensions work, et cetera, where there's no reconciliation between women's ambitions to work and women's ambitions to have children. They're choosing one or the other. So you see really catastrophic falls in birth rates in Catholic countries where people might still have kind of conservative social mores, you know, especially within families like Spain and Poland and Italy. And you see things, you know, birth rates are slightly below replacement, but not in a way that's kind of problematic in France and Scandinavia, you know, which are the countries that have policies that I think, you know, women like us in the United States can only long for.
And I know. I fantasize about it constantly. I mean, and I know a lot of women, you know, who wish that if they were like, oh, if only I could live in Sweden, I would have a baby on my own, because I know that I would have the social support, you know, which could be a solution to baby panic. I mean, you know, maybe a lot of the baby panic is women are working and working because they want to get to an economic position, and they're sort of fighting against their procreative power and their economic power.
Well, and they have to. And this is something that actually made me kind of sad when I was reading the introduction to your book. And you talked about how you felt all of a sudden like, you know, kind of your personal situation and also all of this attention to baby panic made you question your own personal choices. Made you think. And what made me sad about that, I mean, besides the fact that you shouldn't have to go through that, is that that's actually a really dangerous place for women to be. I mean, for women to feel like in order to have the kind of lives, you know, that they want, they need to put themselves in a more... They need to tamp down their ambitions, and they need to put themselves in a more subservient position. It's not just that it's not going to be fulfilling, although I don't think it will be fulfilling. It's really dangerous. I mean,
I think so too. I think that the message, you know, what started me off on this book was, you know, was reading this book by the economist Sylvia Han Hewitt called Creating a Life, and she sent this message that said, you know, everybody just needs to start earlier. How hard is it? I mean, think about yourself at 25. I mean, Michelle, you're a rather precocious young woman, but still think of yourself at 35. I mean, at 25, like, would you have been ready to have a kid?
Well, I'm not ready to have a kid at 33.
I know.
But the thing is, some women, you know, might very well be ready to have a kid at 25 if they had the kind of generous social supports,
exactly.
You know, subsidized daycare.
Right.
And also, if you weren't taking such a risk, given, you know, to kind of drop out in our economy, to drop out, to make yourself economically dependent on a man who doesn't really have any, you know, who can leave at any moment and leave you essentially destitute.
Right.
I mean,
it's such a
risky decision.
Yeah. In a country with a 43% divorce rate, to become solely economically dependent on your husband without having, you know, at least a few years in the workforce and, you know, possibly a master's degree, it's a risk. I mean, that might be a snobby thing for me to say, but I worry about, you know, those women who are losing their economic power in you know, by putting their procreative power first.
And yet there is also an actual problem in Well, I mean, one of the reasons I thought Sylvia Ann Hewlett's book was incredibly sloppy. It's, you know, its methodologies, let's ask women what they wanted when they were 18, or, you know, you kind of ask women who are in their 40s, well, did you want this life when you were 18, and then assume you can extrapolate on the basis of that. But where it did, part of the reason it did hit home is that there is a problem with the way things are currently arranged.
Right, and there's also a problem with the fact that biology, the way things are currently arranged biologically. I mean, we should have a conversation with Mother Nature and tell her that, you know, we really need another 10 years for our biological clock, and could she actually change things? Unfortunately, I don't think that's ever going to change. And what's so interesting is that we are the only species on the planet with biological clocks.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we are. I mean, there's actually a whole theory that the reason that we have biological clocks is a lot of anthropologists come up with this idea called the grandmother's theory.
Oh, I have seen that.
Yeah, which is, you know, the idea that women stop being, you know, fertile because they don't want their mothers, daughters shouldn't have to compete with their mothers.
Well, I also thought that there was a kind of Darwinian advantage to have to a society that has grandmothers.
Yeah, there is. I mean, you have the social help. So it's like, the question is like, how old is too old to have a kid? If we can use advanced reproductive technology now to, you know, freeze our eggs. I got my eggs frozen when I was 86.
Well, this is one of the things that's kind of, you know, that's kind of radical about your idea, right? Which is that you're kind of saying if we can't change the society and I think, we need to change the society, but we're certainly, the chances of us doing it by the time our own biological clocks go kaput is unlikely. So you're saying, you know, if we can't change society, maybe we can change our biological clocks, and maybe we can change our biology. I mean, it's an incredibly radical idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that now the idea is basically merging feminism and technology. We have all of this advanced reproductive technology that's available now, including egg freezing, which potentially could be as, you know, revolutionary to our generation and to women who are in their 20s now, as the birth control was to our mothers. You know, it may let you freeze your eggs when you're younger, so you have them, you have an insurance policy, and you can use them when you're 35, you can use them when you're 40, you can use them when you're 45. I mean, I don't know how old is too old, because, like, going back to this grandmother's theory, like, you know, I sort of would like to have a child when my mom is still around so she can help.
But not just, I mean, can you tell me a little bit about how it works and then kind of, and what the success rates are? I mean, I know the success rates of IVF are not great. Is it safer to freeze your eggs?
The success rates of IVF, okay, so egg freezing and IVF have both been around since the 1980s. You know, if you look back at the 80s and you look at the success rates of IVF, I mean, it's unbelievable how much more successful there is. It's like probably around, some clinics are claiming like a 50% success rate. It depends on your age. It depends on what your medical conditions are. You know, it depends on what kind of infertility you're dealing with. I mean, the success rates with donor eggs, meaning, you know, using younger women's eggs and, you know, fertilizing them either with donor sperm and then implanting them in your womb, or fertilizing them with your husband or boyfriend or partner's sperm, is very high. It's, I mean, because, you know, young eggs fertilize. Freezing younger eggs is still an experimental technology according to the Society for Reproductive Medicine. So it's still in the realm of experimental. But like IVF and like other advanced reproductive technologies, you know, it is improving every year. And so the success rates for freezing your eggs, which basically involves, you know, giving yourself drugs in order so your ovaries grow more follicles and produce more eggs, and then surgically removing your eggs and freezing them in liquid nitrogen, which sounds painful and sort of scary out in, like, the sci-fi realm. And it is, but, you know, having
done
it.
Well, and also, is it dangerous at all to be taking those kind of, putting those kind of hormones
in your... there have been a lot of studies now. I mean, that was, like, my one big thing I freaked out on when I did it. And I basically found a study looking at IVF and You know, the relationship between IVF drugs, fertility drugs, and cancer, there have been no direct links found yet. Basically, people that did IVF and ended up developing cancer, or ovarian or breast cancer, basically had it in their family anyway, so they could have developed it anyway. And then in terms of egg freezing, which has a higher success rate if you do it in your 20s or below 35. I did it when I was over 35, but that was because I was considered biologically young, and a lot of women are biologically young and therefore will have successful chances.
How does that work? Is that just if you're healthy?
I think it's honestly genetic. Like, it happens to be that some women go into early menopause at a certain age, and some women are fertile for 10 years. I mean, generally, you know, when you enter your 30s, it's like fertility becomes like an enormous sort of period of variability, where some women's fertility falls off a cliff at 35.
And that's what's so tricky, right? You know, because 35 sounds so arbitrary, especially
it's
because
it's very arbitrary, which is why that whole baby panic started by, you know, creating a life was sort of, you know, like in a way false, and 35 is sort of a false age. I mean, what 35 really is it's the age that doctors start doing amniocentesis tests, because it is around that time that there are more possibilities for genetic anomalies. But it's definitely not dividing line. You know, there's a lot of women who get pregnant at 37 and decide not to do genetic testing. And there are a lot of women that get pregnant very easily at 41. I mean, and then there are a lot of women that also have trouble and need to turn to. You don't really ever know what your fertility is. I mean, there are a lot of tests you can take now. But just getting back to the egg freezing thing, you know, there was just a report done by the University of Bologna, where it was invented, and NYU, Dr. Nicole Noyes, who is my doctor, who froze my eggs, and they have found that actually 900 babies have now been born worldwide, and they found that there were no genetic anomalies among the babies born from frozen eggs that was different from babies born in the general population. I mean, some of those babies did have genetic anomalies, but it was no different than if you took 900 babies born from, you know, regular pregnancies.
And what about, and how long, how, what's the latest you can...
You
What's
can freeze
the latest?
Your eggs.
You can be reimplanted, I guess. Is that the term?
Oh, right. You can be reimplanted. God, that's a really good question. I mean, if you can get a good embryo from frozen eggs, why couldn't you be reimplanted at 50? I mean, Elizabeth Edwards had a baby probably with donor eggs at 51.
So tell me, I mean, you've been writing about this, and I can only imagine, well, on the one hand, I mean, there's part of me that says... There's part of me that thinks, you know, why do we have to go through this? It sounds pretty onerous. You know, why can't we arrange society in a more holistic way?
Oh my God, I wake up at night thinking about that question.
I mean, was it a difficult process to go through? Was it
Egg freezing? You know, it wasn't. Look, you know, we live in the most vain society in the world, maybe besides Brazil, and you know, people get like boob jobs and nose jobs, and like, I mean, you know, I have a feeling that getting your eggs frozen is a lot less painful than getting your boobs done.
But I mean, what do you think about the argument that, you know, that we should be trying to arrange society around our biology instead of vice versa?
I mean, I think that all choices should be on the table for women. I think that egg freezing could potentially be, you know, I sometimes have fantasies that, like, you know, there's government subsidized egg freezing, or insurance companies cover it under the, you know, idea of preventative medicine.
You know, you mean preventative for infertility?
Yeah, preventative for infertility. I mean,
but
you know,
do insurance companies cover infertility treatments?
Some. I mean, it's a slippery slope. I think, you know, most insurance plans will cover, I think, 3 IVF cycles.
Which is still more expensive than egg freezing, right?
IVF and egg freezing are about the same. But egg freezing is absolutely not covered by insurance at this point. I think some companies, I mean, one of the things also that's really great about egg freezing is say you like have ovarian cancer or say you have any kind of cancer and you have to go through chemo.
Is it covered in those instances?
In some, I think some really good insurance plans, like, you know, like I did a piece for Newsweek about my egg freezing, and my editor at Newsweek told me that actually egg freezing is covered under Newsweek's plan if for cancer. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of questioned, like, why it has to be cancer? Like, why can't it just be, you know, I mean, there's like this whole concept now of social egg freezing. Like, what if you haven't met Mr. Wright? And you, what if you meet Mr. Wright at 39 and he's the love of your life? I mean, then you can say to him at 41, wow, we've been together for 2 years. I'm worried about my fertility, but I do have these eggs I froze at 30 or 29. I mean, that kind of sweetens the pot.
But what about, I mean, I could imagine, and I'm curious to talk about the reaction to your piece in Newsweek and to your other writing about this. I mean, I could imagine that at a time when, you know, healthcare costs are already such a big issue, and, I mean, I actually can't politically imagine the United States government proposing to, I think it would be politically impossible, even if it would be, you know, desirable. And I imagine that that you must have, you know, gotten, that there must have been at least a somewhat angry reaction.
I wouldn't say it was angry. I mean, somebody told me that I had a sense of entitlement for asking the government to pay for me to postpone my pregnancy. But then again, you can also argue that the government pays for a lot of 18-year-old welfare people to have children, you know, single moms. I mean, you know, I don't know if, you know, I'm making
well, what
like
that? I mean, I'm not sure if that's, but you could also argue that that's not, I mean, it's not quite paying them to have children. It's, you know,
no,
supporting
I'm not
them
saying it's
when
paying
they get
them
it.
To have children. It's supporting them to have children. But maybe what we need is better education in this country so there's less, you know, younger single moms who need government support and, you know, the money needs to be, you know, allotted. I mean, this is a radical idea. I mean, maybe the
but
money
But I think,
to...
I mean, but what, I mean, what would bother, what bothers me about that idea is the idea that we need to, I mean, I'm all for increased sex education and increased pregnancy prevention and, you know, increased abortion provision where women want it. But I I'm kind of uncomfortable with the idea of policies that would be premised on transferring resources from poor younger women to middle-class older women.
To middle-class older women, right. So I'm not saying that maybe the government should cover it, but I am saying that maybe insurance companies should cover it.
Well, certainly they should cover it if they're covering IVF. I mean, it's...
Right, exactly. More what I'm saying.
And it's interesting that, you know, and that where this fits into the birth strike idea is that, you know, the one reason that this is not going to be covered ever, or one reason that this is not going to be covered and that that's not really on the table for covering it for government support for this in the United States is because we don't have a problem with declining birth rates here. Largely because of immigration, because of some other, you know, because in certain... to a certain degree because of very high birth rates among the religious, you know, the highest birth rates in the country are in Utah, and because of a whole number of other factors, some of them really, really contradictory. But in countries where they are really worried about demographics, it's quite different. And my understanding is that I actually don't know about egg freezing in Israel, but I know that in Israel, the government will pay for unlimited IVF, up to a pretty old, you know, I think they're the most aggressive in terms of how old you can be when you get it.
I mean, that's great. You know, I just read, there was a study, I actually blogged about your book on my blog on True Slant, and I talked about it in relationship to a study that just came out in the Journal of Fertility and Sterility, and it said that the cost of advanced reproductive treatment did not exceed 0.25% of total health care expenditure in any country. So actually, governments are not spending very much money on advanced reproductive technology. They actually could be spending more.
What I would be curious about, but it gets then so political, and it gets so political about governments saying, well, this is about getting certain kind of people to have more children.
Well, exactly. So elitist. It's like, are you going to pay for the wealthiest part of society to have children when, you know, I mean, yeah, it could be a total problem in terms of elitism, yeah.
Right, and especially in a context of Europe where people are panicking about Muslims having too many children. I mean, it's so sticky, and yet one part of where this kind of overlaps,
with
other
strike?
Issues,
yeah.
with late term abortion is that it's so when you're thinking about your own life and your own decisions, you're not thinking, you know, and it's unrealistic to expect anybody to make their life decisions based on these kind of meta political questions.
I know. I was thinking that exact same thing when I was reading, all this about Tiller, and you know, I mean, every story is individual. Every mm-hmm. woman that had a late term abortion is individual. Every woman who is maybe thinking about getting their eggs frozen or, you know, wants a child, it's like every story is individual. So these like meta, you know, morality plays on all of this are just, you know, terrible. It's like it's got to be done on an individual basis. And I think, you know, that's why I respect the abortion doctors that look at it as, you know, look at each woman as an individual case.
Right. That's why, I mean, it's so heartbreaking to see that Tiller's Clinic isn't going to reopen. I mean, partly because the message is terrorism works.
Yeah, I know.
But also because Tiller especially, and I wrote about this in the American Prospect, I mean, more than a lot of doctors who do abortions and who've been targeted by the anti-abortion movement become necessarily kind of prickly and combative, and Tiller could be a little bit combative with his opponents, but what he was known for among the women who had to see him was just such kindness and such empathy, and I'm sure it will, you know, make the blood boil of the anti-abortion movement to hear this, but people in the movement called him Saint George because he took the hardest cases and he took them whether or not they could pay. And his clinic was known for kind of ministering for both the quality of its healthcare, but also for the quality of its like emotional and psychological support. It had a chapel on the premises. You know, people would go through these intense counseling sessions, individual and in groups. And there's just nothing else like that. I mean, there's two other doctors where women will be able to, some women will be able to go when they find themselves in these kind of hideous situations, but
right. I mean,
what we've lost is so profound.
I know, and that's what's so horrible about the anti-abortionists is that, you know, the fact that they assume that every woman is like this cold-hearted woman who's getting a, you know, first-term, second-term, or third-term abortion. I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, I am pro-choice. I am not pro-abortion. I mean, I, you know, if you can prevent an unwanted pregnancy, prevent it, but you know, and that's where, you know, education comes in, and that's where, but this morality of the fact that these women are cold-hearted, I mean, I'm sure women that were getting third-term abortions in, you know, Tiller's clinic were spending hours in that chapel beforehand. I would.
Yeah, nobody changes their mind in the eighth month and says, you know what, screw it. I mean, that's just not how it works. And what I think is interesting about the way this debate has evolved since the murder is that there was such a consensus, this kind of smug and thoughtless consensus before Dr. Tiller was assassinated, that, well, we can all agree on the utter immorality of what people called partial birth abortion. I mean, that's why those bans have passed with such high margins, and people have felt so secure in condemning them, even if they were nominally pro-choice. And
right,
it's been really interesting to see those people. I've been reading Andrew Sullivan's blog constantly, in which he's kind of trying to reconcile his, you know, longtime opposition to these kinds of abortions with the individual stories that have apparently been pouring in. And what
right.
There was one
story on the about the woman who was, I can't, what was it? She was going to Italy, and then she decided she didn't want to lose her education, and
that was actually, I mean, that was both one of the most kind of harrowing and maybe one of the most, I mean, I don't want to say morally ambiguous. I mean, there are some of them that are just so obvious, right? There are some of them that are so, you know, this baby is a wanted baby, and it's not going to,
Right, if you know that you're going to give birth to a kid, say, that has, like, Tay-Sachs or Canavan, and that kid is probably going to live for 2 or 3 months, I mean, I don't know. You know, that's where, or if, you know, whatever the famous case is that the child that developed without a brain. I mean.
But the interesting thing about that woman, the one you're talking about, the woman who, yeah, she basically, she was pregnant, she didn't want to be, but she had decided that she was going to carry the baby to term and give it up for adoption. So she went ahead on, I think, a foreign exchange program Italy, and then just realized that psychologically she couldn't do it. And I think, you know, again, I think the point that she made that I think is so true is that she was, I think she said that she was herself conflicted about abortion, or I don't, maybe she was anti-abortion, definitely uncomfortable with abortion.
Yeah.
But she just couldn't do it. And, you know, I've heard this, every kind of abortion doctor I've ever spoken to, or everyone that I've ever spoken to who works in a clinic, say that they see people all the time who tell them, well, I'm against abortion, but this situation is different. And the moral of these stories is that every woman's situation is different.
Everybody is individual. I mean, this is where, like, it can get back to both of our books. It's that, I mean, the morality... The conservative morality of doctors, I have such a hard time with that. I mean, it's like there are all these in Her Unsweet Time, there are like all of these women, especially like I spent a bunch of time in Texas talking to single moms. And, you know, a bunch of the single moms told me stories about how they would go into these fertility clinics. And, you know, they would say, and these doctors would say, oh, I'm not going to treat you because you're single. I'm not going to inseminate you with donor sperm. You're single. You're, you know, I don't treat single women. Are you saying that you want to get pregnant, you know, because you're a single woman? Is that code word for lesbian? Like, this morality of these doctors, like, medical care is like a relationship between a patient and a doctor. And what made Tiller so wonderful is that he was a doctor. He looked at the case by case individual. I mean, we're moving into a culture of individualized medicine. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the choice to have an abortion, the choice to get impregnated as a single mom, the choice to get your eggs frozen, the choice to use in vitro fertilization. These are all individual choices for individual women and couples, and I don't like doctors that are moral about these decisions.
Well, and part of the morality means, and this is, again, I mean, goes back to Tiller, you know, his motto that he put on buttons was trust women.
Yeah. Exactly.
Let me ask you this.
It's punishing to women. It's saying, it's these doctors that are being paternalistic, and they're saying, I don't trust your choice.
Did you ever talk to doctors like that when you were researching your book, or people who said, you know, yeah, people who were basically, you know, kind of opposed to this whole direction in reproductive medicine?
I didn't talk to doctors about, but I know that there are a lot of doctors that, for example, will not inseminate a single woman if she wants to be, or do fertility treatments on a single woman. I mean, there were two women in my book who are single mothers by choice in Texas, and they both actually
God, what a hard place to do it.
I know, and they actually got pregnant both did donor eggs and donor sperm. And, you know, they both have two beautiful twins that are not genetically related to them, but they're their moms. And one of them, you know, went down this path, and there were a bunch of, you know, fertility clinics that she walked into around the, you know, Dallas area. I mean, she lives in Plano, Texas, where, you know, it's like God TV is there. and they walked in and he said, I'm not going to treat you. You know, which is very similar to, you know, it's very similar to what you talk about in your book, you know, this conservative culture, you know, driving women's rights.
Let me ask you this. I mean, given the kind of depth of the backlash against women, I tend to keep myself very much out of my writing, and in part just because I'm somewhat of a private person, and in part because the culture of the internet, where I've spent, you know, a lot of my career, I, you know, worked for Salon almost since they started, and I've, you know, written for tons of other online publications, and just being dissected in the comments to me eviscerating. I mean, it's paralyzing. And it's, I think it has changed the way I approach my writing. I think I have a voice, but I keep myself in terms of my own story out of it. And I actually wish, you know, there's things I wrote that were more confessional when I was a lot younger that I wish I could, you know, go back in time and erase. And so I'm curious because your book, and one of the reasons I found it really compelling, you know, and not just because I know you, but because, you know, I find it really compelling, that window into the life of a woman that has a lot in common with me. But did you feel, vulnerable, or do you feel vulnerable now?
I feel incredibly vulnerable. But you know what? So far, the dissection has not been horrible. I mean, I think the worst comment that I got was that comment about like how I have this sense of entitlement and that I'm selfish that I froze my eggs, or I'm selfish that, why, you know, the women who are thinking about becoming single mothers are selfish. But it hasn't been so terrible. I mean, who knows what, you know, the people, you know, in my sort of different layers of people who know me are saying behind my back. But, you know, most of the reaction has been that it's really brave to put your personal story out there. And, you know, it's sort of like the personal is political. I mean, I don't know. What do I have to lose?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, it's not so, to me, it's not, if you feel like you have nothing to lose, I mean, it's more just that what I have to lose is just that I can't take it, you know?
You can't take the criticism.
Well,
it's like a sort of world psychoanalysis, like putting the story out there. It's like people are going to like analyze, like, and it'll maybe like help me in like the course of my life. I don't know. No, I just wanted to give women the strength. I wanted to be strong and put my story out there so other women could be strong and talk about these issues with their friends or with, you know, whoever, so it doesn't feel like it's something to be a source of shame. Because, you know, the thing that I'm discovering within Our Own Sweet Time is that it's like the most unbelievably common story now. You know, this is not like I'm not some weird cultural anomaly, you know, and that's like, in fact, very comforting for me because, you know, there were times, especially when like this like baby panic, you know, was that I felt like I did something wrong. Like I made wrong choices. And you know what, Michelle, maybe I did make wrong choices. I mean, but you know, maybe it's just that, you know, I made choices and, you know, I mean, I just think that the more options that we have now, the more that you can, you know, I feel like everything I've done now has been very proactive. You know, and then maybe maybe there are people out there, there are women out there, there are men out there that are use my story, and they'll say, you know, I don't want to do it that way. I have another way, and it'll help people in that way.
The whole idea of making wrong choices, though, there's obviously such a thing as wrong choices, but
right.
It's so difficult to evaluate it. I mean, you know, you could have just as easily, you know, had a baby with someone and if the relationship wasn't working and if you were kind of, you know, if you were suppressing your own ambition and your own personality, the chances of that marriage lasting are not great. And, you know, you'd be a single mother with a lot less resources than you'll potentially have going into it at this stage of your life.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. And there are so many trajectories. And then, you know, I think that's really interesting, like, you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this, like the whole concept of having it all. Like, do you actually, like, do you want to have it all? I mean, and I'm sorry I'm asking a personal question because I know you don't like to talk about it. But, like, you know, you're so intellectually steeped in, you know, in these ideas in the developing world and in the developed world about fertility and women's rights and women's choices. And I would, you know, Michelle, I would actually be really interested to see a personal essay from you about, you know, I mean, you wrote an essay for Maybe Baby about
Yeah, that was years ago. I wrote about how difficult it is to make the decision whether or not to have a child. I think I wrote about how when you're contemplating whether or not to have a child, and, you know, it's become an especially stark issue for me because, like I said, I'm 33, and, you know, as you wrote, 35 is a kind of fulcrum in this whole debate.
Right, although it may not be. I mean, you should get your fertility tested and see where you are.
But the thing is, and the thing is that I am so ambivalent. I certainly don't have that that hunger or really any internal sense of wanting a child. But right. I do have either, well, I have two things. I have one, a fear that that's going to kick in at the exact moment that my fertility goes out.
Right.
And then, two, the fact that, you know, my life is actually arranged, and I mean, I would have to give up a lot to have a child, but actually, you know, I'm married, I've been married for a long time, you know, my husband and I both have careers, I'm actually kind of situated to have a child.
And then you think about, what would you have to give up, and would you be willing to give it up? I mean, you know, being a writer at home and doing what we do is actually incredibly conducive to motherhood. I mean, you know, my mom had me and my brother actually at 40, and she worked at home as a writer. And, you know, there were babysitters around, but she was always in the house and, you know, she was there. And
right. I mean, for me, the difference is that I travel a lot, and there are certain kinds of traveling that are more conducive to having, you know,
it's true.
Like
you're not gonna be going to.
Right, I'm not gonna be going to Northern Uganda or to.
Right. Although, you know, Elizabeth Rubin, the Times war correspondent, I think had a baby as a single mother.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder. Yeah. Do you know if she was pregnant when she was in
Afghanistan?
Apparently,
I mean, this, you know, this is not me reporting
right.
that.
Okay.
This is me having a conversation with somebody. But I have heard that she was pregnant when she was reporting.
But this is, you know, and I think I would actually do that. I actually think I would be fine traveling
right.
while pregnant, but certainly you're not going to be toting around, you know, a baby Bjorn in a war zone. But
probably not. But, you know, you may be toting around a baby Bjorn in when, you know, I mean, a lot of your book is, a lot of the means of reproduction is, you know, is trips and interviews in countries. I mean, you know, who's to say that you can't to carry around a baby Bjorn and set up your interviews and,
well,
you know,
certainly, I mean, I think you could do it to a certain degree in, you know, in India, you could certainly, I mean, who knows, maybe, you know, people with children might be watching this and snickering and being like, yeah, you wait.
I do think that there is this sort of fear among women, and particularly I've noticed this among, like, New York and, like, American women, that, like, it's got to be this, like, perfectly sterile environment, and it's, everything's got to be right. Like, kids are really adoptable. I mean, look at, like, I always, like, take the example of, like, when I was traveling in Southeast Asia when I was in my 20s, and I saw, like, the hippie couples, you know, who had kids and traveled
right. yeah,
with
no,
each other.
Right, yeah, no, I see them all the time, and I always thought that, I mean, I envied most of those kids. Occasionally you would see, especially in India, you would see some mother who had kind of gotten involved in a cult, you know, toting around some miserable
right.
little child.
But Michelle, my instinct are is that that's not going to be you.
But no, I actually, I mean, who knows? I think that I think that part of that intense neuroses, and maybe I'm wrong, but part of that, like, intense, everything has to be perfect, maybe comes from a sense of how much you gave up to make it happen.
I definitely have noticed that among, I mean, you know, I think that if you do it earlier, it's integrated into your life, and that's just what it is. And, you know, some women have regrets about it, some don't, some just don't even know. And I do think that the older you get, the more you're like, wow, I'm going to have to give this up. And so, I mean,
and
you know,
I think also women who are so used to being incredibly hard-charging perfectionists in their professional life
and in control, this is not a thing, a choice that is about really very much about control.
Which is also, I actually think, why children are maybe, who knows, children are maybe better off. I don't want to say that. I mean, women, you know, but I also think there's something to be said for keeping another part of your life alive so that you don't force this child to bear the brunt of all of your displaced ambitions.
I mean, I have seen so many of my friends with, you know, moms who stayed at home who are neurotic, you know, reciprocators of their mother's displaced ambition. It's not always so pretty. I mean, I love that my mom was available to me most of the time at home, but, you know, I could knock on her study door. Sometimes she would say, go away, I'm writing. But, you know, but I also love the fact that she was my role model, and look what I became. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, it's nice to have a mother with a great career who has a, you know, is a role model to you.
Wait, can I ask a question? As a writer whose mother is a writer, I mean, or as a journalist,
yeah,
do you feel at all, you know, and honestly, this is something that's been in my head, is that if I was a, you know, if having a child was something that was going to be difficult before, well, there's two things. On the one hand, now it seems even more daunting because our profession is becoming even more Darwinian. And in certain ways, it's disappearing out from under our feet.
I know. Well, I wouldn't say it was disappearing out from under our feet. It's changing very radically, and we're having to play major catch-up.
So, I mean, you know, it seems like it's one thing to have a child when you
have, like, a good job. I know my dad worked for the New York Times and has a penchant, you know. And now, like, a lot of reporters that work for the New York Times are getting laid off, or if they're not getting laid off, they're being made freelance and losing their health benefits, and that means you have to start paying for your own health benefits, and then, yeah, it's completely scary.
Although the other thing is that there's also I think that especially for me, sometimes I think, well, it's a way out, but that's at the worst possible approach.
Wait,
because everything else is going to hell.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're always going to be a writer, Michelle. I mean, that's
well, yeah,
just
I mean, I'll be
are.
A writer even it because I certainly have no other.
Yeah, you're always gonna figure out. I mean, you write books. You're always gonna be. I mean, book. You may be getting lower advances, but you know, I don't think books are, you know, people read. People, you know, that's what's so interesting about all this journalism is going to hell in a handbasket. We are living in an interactive word culture more than ever before because we spend half our time staring and typing on computer screens. This is just an issue of monetizing that's going on right now, I think.
But I also think, the experience of reading online, and I do a lot of reading online, and I do a lot of writing online, but I'm almost not even sure it's the same category of
as the sturdy old book.
Yeah, it's not even, to me it doesn't seem like the same mental processes, you know? It doesn't seem like it's this kind of much, I don't feel like you absorb information in the same way
online
on the internet.
It doesn't reward
writing in the same way.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's much quicker. I mean, writing a book is, I mean, I don't know, the satisfaction of finishing a book and putting it back on your bookshelf and sort of having it be a thing is probably very different than, like, finishing a book on Kindle and, like, clicking end or something. I don't know. There's something.
I guess I don't even know. Maybe I'm wrong, but do people even finish books on Kindle, or do you, you know, click around from one to the other and get?
Really, what's very interesting to me, and I've noticed that people talking to me about In Her Own Sweet Time is that, you know, they're not reading it in a linear fashion. I mean, a bunch of my friends are reading it in a linear fashion, but a lot of readers are like, oh yeah, I jumped around. I looked at the parts that were relevant to me. I looked at the chapters that were relevant to me. So I actually think, you know, what's happening is that, you know, just narrative is not linear anymore. So even in books, you know, maybe, you know, there's a non-linear nature to the to narrative, and that's, you know, coming into the book reading world as well. Hello?
Hello?
Oh,
hello?
We lost her. Oh, you're there?
Hey, what happened?
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Oh, we blipped out for a second.
Yeah.
Where were we talking?
You were talking about books and them not being linear. And in a way, I mean, I guess that, you know, some of these kind of people who are, you know, apostles of this new digital revolution may think that that's great and that empowers readers, but it also seems to suggest even kind of greater, you know, narcissism and an even greater, you know, already you can just read the news that pertains to you. What's that?
Because people are, like, only going to the parts of books that, like, are relevant to their own
lives.
That
totally pertain to, I mean, that's already, you know, this kind of increasing personalization of the media already threatens to kind of narrow our horizons.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a book that's keyword searchable seems to be, you know, a step in a similar direction. I don't know.
Yeah,
I wrote recently that this whole thing, I'm really understanding for the first time what it feels like to be a conservative, which is something that I've researched the right for a long time. I've done a lot of writing about the right, but never before have I understood in a visceral way what it feels like to, you know, kind of want to, you know, do what William Buckley said, you know, stand on athwart the tide of history and shout stop. It's only now that, you know, a culture that I really love is being lost and being replaced by something that seems such a pale imitation.
So you think you're a narrative conservative?
I think I might be. Yeah, I think I might be a literary conservative or a journalistic conservative, even though I'm a leftist journalist.
Right. Interesting. I think that is really interesting. I mean, well, do you like to blog?
No, I hate it. I hate it. Oh, my God.
I'm not a really huge...
I mean, maybe we shouldn't be talking about... Maybe we're going to get kicked off Blogging Heads for...
Hello?
Talking about this.
Oh, we lost her again.
But I find it so difficult, and it's so strange because I don't have writer's block. You know, I've written two books.
Happening.
I write articles all the time.
Oh, wait.
I have a
Michelle,
column online.
Michelle, I lost you again.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I don't know why. It blipped out again.
Well, we were talking, and I was saying that I don't understand why I find blogging so difficult because I don't find writing difficult. And there's something about maybe it's just because I'm used to the smallest unit I know how to conceptualize in my head is an article.
Right.
I don't know if that's what it is or else if it's just, I want to say I'm too old, but I'm not, you know, there's people in their 30s who are fantastic bloggers and who are able to maintain attention on, you know, a dozen different subjects on the same day, whereas it makes me feel like my brain is being devoured by termites.
Yeah, I find myself in a very similar position. Well, I mean, you know, you and I were in very many ways, I mean, the whole reason that we know each other is because of Clay Felker, and we were very much, you know, trained in the style of new journalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, long-form narrative journalism, which was essentially, you know, a reaction against, you know, the TV culture. You know, it was a way to compete with the TV culture, and you know, maybe is long-form narrative journalism, you know, is there something that's a reaction against that, or is there, you know, do you want to remain a conservative in that area, or is there a way to turn long-form narrative journalism into something that works in this new world?
Well, the only way I think it works in this new world is as a respite, because I get the sense that there are a lot of people who are, I mean, look, I certainly don't think you can fight against the new world, and there's certain things bloggers, you know, do really well, and there's certain subjects that I follow avidly on blogs, but I also, I mean, I often when I see, you know, a story bubble up, it's only when I finally read the 4,000 or 5,000 or, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 word story about it in The New Yorker or, you know, The New Republic or The Atlantic that I feel like I really get it. You know, that's especially true of things like the economic crises. It's so much easier for me to absorb information in that way.
I know, exactly. Like, I had such, like, reading your book gave me such a global grasp on what's going on. Like,
right, and you could learn a lot. I mean, some of this reporting is you know, some of the reporting was just me going there. But some of these issues, you could learn about online. But here's what I think. I think a lot of blogs basically delegate to the reader part of the work that the writer used to do. So it used to be the writer's job to organize and systematize and create, you know, kind of a hierarchy of information. Now, in essence, with blogs, that's the job of the individual reader. And it takes work.
Right. So the idea now is that we're just, I mean, content creators, you know, we're just putting content out there. And the question is what is the difference between a professional writer and just, you know, anybody who is good at stringing two sentences together?
Well, and this is interesting because you've been involved in TrueSlant, right? Which is this new effort.
Yeah.
And I find this idea of, you know, the writer as kind of entrepreneur to be both, you know, there's certain things about it that are liberating, especially if, like me, you really enjoy writing books and the freedom that allows. But it also means that this, there's, so, I remember when we were both living in San Francisco, the time of the first kind of internet explosion.
Yeah.
There was all this talk about brand you, which at the time seemed like dystopian hyperbole, and now has become...
And now is absolutely, like, it is Michelle Goldberg and Rachel Lehmann-Haupt show.
Right, exactly. And there's, you know, if you're kind of a hustler, you can make something of that, and it, maybe that's going to be increasingly the distinction between who's a professional and who's an amateur, is who can hustle enough to make a living at it.
Right, and also it's a matter of, it's, I mean, what's also really interesting is that it becomes a big popularity game, because, you know, your writing is going to have to be broader and your internet presence is going to have to be larger, and you want hits because hits means potentially more advertising. I mean,
and that's actually and that actually does really narrow the scope, I think, ultimately, of what people, I mean, both because there's a pressure to be provocative for the sake of provocation, and there's also things that kind of militate against alienating your, either your core readership or the people who are going to link to you and promote you. I mean, I actually think that this in certain ways is going to promote a greater kind of homogenization, even though the irony is that, you know, all the hype is that it's going to let so many flowers bloom.
Right. What do you also think about the whole, like, information? I mean, I remember, like, back in the 90s... when we were all talking about the internet, we were all like, isn't information overload so bad and unhealthy? I mean, going back to, like, you know, if we're going to have kids, like, what are our kids going to experience all of this information as? And, like, that's the question I ask a lot.
I think, you know, I've thought for a while that we're on the cusp of a backlash against... And I've been saying this for a while, and then the other day I saw a commercial for Bing, the new... And I thought that it was fascinating that the commercial for Bing was basically playing into people's sense of information overload and sense of kind of bombardment and disorientation. I feel like when the technology companies pick up on this ambient... unease, then it really is part of the zeitgeist. You know, I thought you could even see that with response to Twitter. I mean, some people love Twitter, but a lot of the response to it especially among journalists was like, oh God, do I have to? Okay, fine.
Right.
You know, and you saw, like, my friend Farhad, who I used to work with, who's at Slate now, you know, wrote this article about kind of assuring people, no, don't worry, you don't have to do it if you don't want. But there was this sense of kind of compulsion, especially among journalists who maybe feel like they've been, you know, missed out the first time around with blogs, who, you know, now feel like they have to be early adopters of everything. And, you know, at a certain point, to bring it back around to what we were talking about at the very beginning.
Yeah.
At a certain point, if our social arrangements are not working for us, you know, maybe we have to change them instead of changing ourselves.
Right. Well, there are two things. It's like, okay, so does talent rise to the top? Like, maybe that's it. Maybe it's just going to be like the art world. Like, you know, talent and good art rises to the top. Really,
do you think that's
writing
true? I mean, I feel like I almost feel like this would be, it would be a nightmare if the journalism world was like the art world in terms of the amount of marketing and kind of hype and Dutch tulip mania that surrounds it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely becoming part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and then, and I, you know, I don't know. And then just in terms of, like, changing our social systems, I don't know. I mean, what are we talking about now? Changing our journalism system or changing the way that women have children? But they are sort of related because there are careers and there are choices to become mothers.
Well, they're careers and they're both actually a result of us being tethered to a, you know, they're both a result of us being tethered to an information economy that's increasingly experienced as a kind of, hideous taskmaster.
Right. Well, you know what's also really interesting? Here's one of the, like, sort of pieces of wisdom that I give in her own sweet time. And I think it's really, like, as things, there become so many choices. Like, I talk about, you know, this book. Have you ever heard about this book? It's called The Paradox of Choice. And it's, like, the idea that we live in a culture where there are so many choices now that it can be sort of overwhelming. And actually, like, too many choices, it's really great to have all of this information at your fingertips. But too many choices can actually, like, lead to depression. Like anxiety and depression. And I talk about that in terms of sort of choices for women. You know, actually, you know, there was that, I think it was ran on the XX Factor on Slate. There was that, it was this new study about happiness in women. Mm-hmm. And it was about how, like, since the 1960s, women have become less happy. And, like, I started thinking about that, like, within the context of choice. And, you know, like, maybe it's because we have so many choices now, it's, you know, it's become overwhelming, and maybe that, you know, is kind of what's leading to maybe feeling unhappy, although I don't know how unhappy
I am. Right, although the last thing I want to do is then use that as an argument for restricting
for creating,
any choices,
right,
which is this
exactly,
kind of cul-de-sac.
Choices. Right, exactly. But exactly, you don't want to create a new, like, you don't want to, like, go back to the 1950s. So what my argument in Her Own Sweet Time is that you just, it's really about, you know, really drilling down and figuring out, almost like taking a playbook from the conservatives and, like, really drilling down and figuring out what your values are and kind of staying on course with your values so you don't get, like, overwhelmed by all the choices.
You know, that might be a good place for us to end, because I'm kind of thinking we could go on and on and on.
Forever. I know. Anyway, it was great talking
to you. Anyway, it was so good talking to you, and I'm so grateful for anyone who has, you know, stuck it out through this whole conversation, given all the other multiplicity of choices available on the internet.
Absolutely, me too.
Okay, see you
all
soon.
Right, talk to you later. Bye.